good to go.
All right. So, good afternoon, everybody. You know, for me, I sat in this class, you know, it was like a couple of years ago, but it's been more than a few years ago. I'm Jason Mulich. I'm an assistant professor here. I'm from Buffalo. I did my undergrad at UB, master's at Roswell, PhD at Roswell, and if there's any questions, you know, you have for me in terms of the lecture or, you know, in terms of, you know, your next steps, you know, it's coming around quickly, you know, feel free to get a hold of me. But anyways, today we're going to be talking about immunotherapy, and I'm going to focus specifically on melanoma and kidney cancer, renal cell carcinoma. And the reason I focus on those, there's a lot going on right now in this field. It's exploding. And, you know, if we move out into too many different diseases, there's a lot of different things going on. So I'm going to try to keep it focused on those two specific disease areas. So why is there so much interest in immunotherapy right now? You know, what is really driving this resurgence in using the immune system to treat malignant disease? Well, I think this slide does a pretty good job of giving you an idea of what the benefits and advantages are of these types of therapies. So again, it feels like yesterday. I mean, you guys remember Indiana Jones? You know him? Last Crusade? Is that you know?
You're not that old.
Okay, you've seen this movie.
Yeah.
So Sean Connery, he's on his deathbed. He's been mortally injured. Okay, and there's not a whole lot we can do in this situation. They're at what's this site called? Anybody? I can't think of it right now. Petra, right? That's where they are in the site. And, you know, there's no hospital nearby. He just got shot in the gut, and he's got probably 15 minutes to go before he bleeds out. And the only way that they could save him was, you know, a drink from the chalice, from the Holy Grail. So immunotherapy, you know, I still don't think we've reached its promise yet, but really the idea here is for patients that, you know, are in very late stage disease. You know, they're a high risk. You know, for many of these metastatic patients, we're talking overall survival is less than a year. For some patients, we have this Lazarus effect, where we can go from metastatic disease that is throughout the body to after treatment, there's no detectable disease. And that's really what the promise of immunotherapy is, the ability to treat not just that primary tumor, but metastatic disease throughout the body. So these four main advantages, I think, are what makes it stand out, you know, over conventional therapies or other available therapies today. So there's exquisite specificity for the target. So I'm going to be talking a lot about T cells today, and these are the effector cells. These are the cells that actually kill the tumor. They're specific for something. They're all specific for something. And they can't, they don't work by remote controls. They actually come into contact with their targets in order to initiate cytolysis. And the advantage of this is that there's not a whole lot of collateral damage to normal tissue that's surrounding that area, or that cell, I should say. So you're really going to have exquisite specificity for the target, unlike, you know, chemo that just targets proliferating cells and you know, kind of properties of general properties of tumor cells. The T cell offers exquisite specificity just for that target that we'll call an antigen. This specificity also allows to target non-resectable tumors. So since there's not a lot of collateral damage, you're able to get at areas that are, you know, for a surgeon very difficult to deal with, or even for radiation it's very difficult to treat. Another advantage of inducing anti-tumor immune response is the ability to generate systemic immunity, so you can target tumors throughout the body. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, you know, there's this idea around that there was these sanctuary sites where tumors could kind of hide out and the immune system couldn't reach. Places like the brain, the lung, we thought were very difficult to have a successful immune response there against the tumor. And now there's a lot of evidence showing that, you know, you can reach brain metastases. You can, the lung is a site that's sensitive to immunotherapy. So really, there isn't a whole lot of areas for the tumor to hide from the T cells and from the anti-tumor immune response. And if you think about this a little bit more in terms of the patient care, oftentimes it's not the primary tumor, right? It's the metastatic tumor, and it's oftentimes the metastatic tumor the clinicians don't even know about. They can't even detect it yet. And this constant surveillance throughout the body allows the immune response to not only target those metastatic lesions that pop up in a scan, but the ones we don't even know about yet. All right, so all that being said, I think this fourth point is the most important. Long-lasting protection, durable anti-tumor immunity. So the promise here really is when we have a successful anti-tumor response, when we have some of these complete responses, that some of these patients, they don't just have that short-term reduction in tumor cell growth or tumor growth, but they're also many years out, there's still no detectable disease. So I think that's really what makes us stand out. There's not the need to keep on treating with a particular type of immunotherapy. We can just monitor these patients at that point and evaluate if there's any progression. I think most of the people in this room, if you're not working in an immunology lab or deeply familiar with it, you might think of this as a new treatment. This idea is a new idea. But really, it's been around for decades. And when I was sitting in your seat, this is the stuff we actually talked about. And we were hoping one day something like this would get back, there'd be more excitement about this kind of idea. So this goes back back to the mid-80s. Steve Rosenberg's team at the NIH, he was treating patients with melanoma and kidney cancer with cytokines, high-dose IL-2. Rosenberg, Mike Loach, Jim Moulet, and a group of investigators there were evaluating whether these therapies could have an effect, again, on metastatic patients with very difficult disease to treat. And they observed that a subset of these patients had these complete responses. They had, not only did the primary tumor shrink down, but they had profound responses. So here's a scan of, this is a patient with renal cell carcinoma. This is kind of an update from Dr. Rosenberg recently published in JI. It's already a few years back now. You can see there's a large tumor here. This is renal cell carcinoma, but it's metastasized into the liver, and it's taken over quite a large portion of this patient's liver. After treatment, this is decades later. Liver's cleared up, can't find the disease. So again, this is a patient that had a very poor prognosis, treated with what we now consider to be outdated high-dose IL-2 therapy. It's not even checkpoint blockade, but they're alive today because of this treatment. We're learning more about the sensitivity of different tumor types. We're learning things we thought weren't responsive to immunotherapy are. But when we talk about what's responsive to both the conventional cytokine therapies like high-dose IL-2, as well as the recent state-of-the-art checkpoint blockade and other strategies, kidney cancer and skin cancer are kind of the two that have been responsive. So I show this slide, usually during my talks to set up what we'll be talking about in terms of our research findings, but I think it's very appropriate for this audience as well. We think of, all these different treatment options we have for patients: chemotherapy, radiation, targeted therapy, immunotherapy. And often we're delivering them as a single agent therapy. But I think knowing what we know now about inducing an effective anti-tumor immune response, we realize that we might have to be a little bit more creative. There's not just one hurdle in order to generate, that response that's capable of shrinking the tumor down, capable of lysing the tumor wherever it's metastasized. There's multiple hurdles to obtain that successful response. So I'll go through this slowly with this audience to tell you exactly what we mean by that. So to generate this this effector response, normally a T cell that's able to recognize that tumor target is on the order of 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 1 million. So it's very few of these cells are able to normally recognize it that are, you know, circulating in our body. And what I mean by that is the naive T cell, the T cell that hasn't experienced antigen yet. Those aren't the numbers that we can hope we'll be able to effectively deal with the tumor burden. So the first thing we need to happen is we need T cells to become activated. They need to proliferate and expand those, you know, those T cells that are specific for that tumor antigen. And we normally consider this to happen in draining lymph nodes. So at these sites, what happens is dendritic cells, they're dendritic cells because they have these long dendrites, these long arms that are presenting antigens, that are presenting those targets. They're set up at vascular highways called high nathaniel venules. Don't worry about HEVs, but they're coming in, they're right by where the T cells are coming into these lymph nodes, okay? They're at the sites of entry. So naive T cells are pouring in, the ones that are specific for the antigen are very rare, and they're really flying through these lymph nodes to try to meet up with their partner that's carrying the antigen. And these dendritic cells, they have dendrites, and they're right by the sites of entry, and it's estimated, this is unbelievable really, 500 to 1500 T cells they see in 1 hour. So just think about that, you know, in terms of the numbers game we have to play here to get, you know, those T cells activated. They're seeing a lot of these as they're whipping through the lymph node. So T cells have to become activated. They need to first infiltrate lymph nodes to become activated. So that's one big part of this. They need to expand. You need to increase those numbers that are specific for the tumor. And as I mentioned before, they don't work by remote control. They have to actually enter the tumor. So that's another critical step. So effector T cells, once they've expanded in the lymph node, they're going to re-enter circulation, and they have to traffic to tumors. They have to actually cross tumor vessels in order to tumor blood vessels in order to reach their tumor targets. And there's additional limitations here as well that we'll get into later on today. For renal cell carcinoma, one of the I think hallmarks of this disease for kidney cancer, something I'll be talking a lot about today. This particular tumor type is extremely well infiltrated by T cells, so one of those hurdles is kind of already inherently overcome in kidney cancer. I think you might want to remember this part. So in terms of the different therapies we'll be talking about, think of dendritic cell vaccination, CTLA-4 blockade, which I'll describe shortly, high-dose IL-2. They're really involved in T cell activation, that initial step of expanding the T cell pool. That's really how we think those therapies are working. They're working by improving that initial pool of cytolytic T cell effectors by activation in lymph nodes. Whereas when we're talking about PD-1 blockade or PD-L1 blockade using antibodies, this is really happening at the tumor site. That's normally how we think of this occurring. There's some evidence to suggest it occurs at other sites as well, but really conventional thinking is that this is occurring at the tumor site, and that's kind of unleashing the response that's already occurring in that microenvironment. Any questions so far? I'm going through. All right, I want to talk a little bit about high-dose IL-2 therapy to give you some background on how this therapy works, what its limitations are, and there is some hope for it also going forward. So really, this is the only FDA-approved immunotherapy utilized for metastatic RCC melanoma going for decades. I still think it's a little underappreciated. There's reasons, it certainly has some disadvantages, but, you know, some clinical trials and some studies have shown complete response rates up to 15%. And really that's above and beyond what can be expected from a lot of these other more recent strategies. So one of the drawbacks is it's highly toxic. You know, these patients can suffer from capillary leak syndrome. They have to constantly be monitored. I was at a conference a couple of years ago with Michael Atkins, who's kind of like the guy in this field in high-dose IL-2 therapy. And for some reason, the conference wasn't much bigger than this room, okay? And, he was there, and I was presenting on high-dose IL-2. Okay? I had to give a talk on high-dose IL-2 for metastatic RCC. And Michael Atkins was going to introduce me. But he was also speaking before I was. And just before I went up to give my talk, he was describing how relieved he was that we're in this new theory, new era of immune checkpoint blockade therapy. And he no longer has to really be as concerned with patients that are on high-dose IL-2 because this type of therapy, checkpoint blockade doesn't have the same kind of side effects, really. And my slides are all set, and it's going to be all about how awesome high-dose IL-2 is, how this therapy still has relevance today. And, that was my quip when I went up there, too. I said, I'm so thrilled that, we're moving on from it. But beyond that, beyond the side effects, it's also something that's very difficult to deliver. These patients, when we're treating them, really, they are going through these long-lived cycles of receiving intravenous IL-2 every 8 hours for 5 days. They're being hooked up and given this treatment, and they go through cycles. And then you kind of decide at this point whether they should continue or not, or go back on treatment later. I'm not sure how familiar you are with RECIST criteria, but just to give you, a quick guide on that. Complete response described before. We can't find tumors. No, there's no measurable tumors. It doesn't mean that there aren't any. It just means that it's not something we can pick up. Partial response following therapy, greater than 30% decrease in tumor size. Stable disease is pretty obvious. And progressive disease, greater than 20% size increase. So here we go. When we're looking at some of the data comparing high-dose IL-2 with checkpoint blockade. This is just for RCC. Again, if we broaden it out, you see response rates all over the place. But objective response, and this is, when you look at objective response, it's partial plus complete response. So you add those two together and you get the objective response rate. High-dose IL-2, about 20% objective response rate. When you look at PD-1, about 12%. PD-1, 25%, CTLA-4, a little bit below that. These numbers have certainly expanded. I should probably update this slide. Importantly, high-dose IL-2 is the greatest level of cytotoxicity as well as management. But complete response rate, here you go. We're right around 10% here. PD-L1 is much lower. PD-1, anywhere I've seen the literature, 5 to 8% is kind of what I'm getting. And CTLA-4 is very little as well. But this is the point I wanted to mention here. When we're talking about high-dose IL-2 treatment, they're estimating this is 80% of complete responders are still disease-free more than 2 years after treatment. Rosenberg, he estimates 70% of them 10 years out. There's still no evidence of disease. So that's kind of the unique benefit that we have with immunotherapy, this kind of durable response that's still happening many years after treatment. And that's, in comparison to things like chemo or targeted therapy, you usually don't see that kind of long-lasting benefit in patients. So when we're, I think something to keep in mind in terms of what's happening in terms of an ongoing immune response. Again, to give you an idea of the numbers that we're looking at in terms of tumor-specific T cells. The cells that are actually decreasing tumor size. Tetramer, this is just giving you an idea of, it's a tool that's used to identify T cells that are specific for a given antigen. So these cells are all positive for an antigen that they're vaccinating against, melanin A. Okay, and it's a very small percentage of at baseline we're seeing 0.1% of T cells are specifically against this antigen. They vaccinate in this study, and you see expansion in some of these patients, but it's still very small, 0.1%. Here we're almost at 1%, and these are the cells that we really need to increase in order to have that effect on the tumor size and to benefit the patient. It's a very small proportion of cells. Characterizing a little further, in terms of T cell infiltration into tumor microenvironment, I told you that renal cell carcinoma is characterized as being heavily infiltrated. It's not the same for different diseases. Melanoma is a sensitive tumor type to immunotherapy, but this isn't, you know, this is something that occurs pretty frequently. You can see lymphocytes that are in the peritumoral region, okay? They're on the outside, but they're not really able to infiltrate the intratumoral regions. And in order to have an effect, they actually have to reach this site, and they're all kind of walled off. And it's not just for melanoma, where I'm just showing you an example here. This is melanoma, but you can have colon tumors, ovarian. There's a number of different tumor types that have not been characterized. The higher level of T-cell infiltration you have in these diseases, independent of any kind of immunotherapy, the better these patients are doing. There's a very famous study from Jerome Gallant's group going back now about 10 years ago, and he showed that T-cell infiltration, the type of T-cell that infiltrated colon tumors, was more indicative of patient prognosis than traditional staging. Like, it was more powerful if these patients had heavy infiltration of T-cells and they were, say, stage 3, than a patient that had low levels and they were stage 2. So, you know, what are the available agents right now beyond high-dose IL-2? We'll talk a little bit about PD-1, PD-L1, CTLA-4, dendritic cell vaccination, near and dear to my heart. I'm not going to talk much today about adoptive T-cell transfer, but that's something that with CAR T-cells has really made a resurgence in the last few years. Okay, so when we're talking about immune checkpoint blockade, I think most of the enthusiasm or not for checkpoint blockade is really on evaluating the ability to inhibit this pathway, to inhibit the PD-1 pathway, either by an antibody blockade of PD-1 itself, or PD-L1 or PD-L2. And there's some, you know, interesting ideas here in terms of how we think it works, but this is, again, a kind of a conventional way of looking at it. And there's different therapeutics that are targeting different points in this pathway. But I would say one reason maybe there's a little bit more enthusiasm right now for PD-1 itself, for blocking PD-1, is there might be less redundancy. So if you block PD-1, you could block interactions with both PD-L1 and PD-L2, versus obviously if you block PD-L1, you still have this interaction to worry about. Okay, so I'll go to the screen here. I can't, so close, I can't read all my text. So there's been, this is a data that goes back a few years now, but there's a lot of promise in terms of what's been happening in blocking PD-1 and PD-L1. PD-1, this is a study by Suzanne Topalian that goes back to New England Journal. You guys probably know the story already. But there, you know, before these results came out, there wasn't a whole lot of enthusiasm. The studies that we saw in murine models, you know, we would kind of, it wasn't that surprising. You know, there's so many different agents that we're evaluating in Journal Club that can, you know, cure a mouse. So why would PD-1 have been any different? But when this study was published, it really was a game changer. So they saw in a number of different disease types, response rates in metastatic patients. Non-small cell lung cancer, something we thought wasn't as responsive. Melanoma, 20%. Renal cell carcinoma, 27%. Durable responses, I think, kind of the most important. So it wasn't just a short-lived burst. These patients had durable responses. And these response rates are on par, better than what we saw with high-dose IL-2. But they don't have the same type of, adverse events that you'd see. Pembrolizumab, response rates in 38% of patients by this study. And PD-L1 also get on this as well. So 45%, 5% of patients were progression-free at 24 weeks. 29% response rate. These are very sick patients, again, with metastatic disease. To give you an idea of what was going on in these tumor lesions. They had biopsies pre and post treatment, and what you would see is, again, this, so here's baseline. You guys probably have to look in your slides because of the way the room's set up, but baseline levels of T-cell infiltration, there's kind of sparse infiltration, and after therapy you can see the T-cells are almost taking over this tumor in a patient that's responding. I think this is very interesting. So patients with melanoma, that's the next slide, but you'll also see in patients with melanoma you have this infiltration. What do we have here? So a different form of immunotherapy, again, you can see prior therapy, sparse infiltration, and then 4 weeks, heavy infiltration, and you can see moving on from there. Here's what I thought was coming next. Vitiligo, you know, this kind of patching of the skin. A lot of the responders, not only when they had reduction tumor size, they also had vitiligo. And it's a condition that was also noted in the earlier adoptive T-cell transfer studies by Dr. Rosenberg, patients responding to therapy that had melanoma, they're shared antigens, they're also getting vitiligo. CTLA-4, it works a little bit different. It works very differently than how we think PD-1 works, actually. So if we think about this is an, you know, is kind of putting the brakes on T-cell activation, this interaction. So we know in order for T-cells to be activated, not only do you need antigen presented in the context of MHC, but you need co-stimulation, right? You need CD80, CD86, engaging with CD28. There's my, you know, 10-second introduction for those of you that haven't taken immunology yet. But this process can be significantly slowed down through interactions with CTLA-4 and CD8 and CD86. So this compound, very simple strategy, in order to reduce the suppression of the T-cell, just use an antibody to block this pathway. So enter in CTLA-4, ipilimumab. So this also was kind of a big deal, and is still a big deal going back a few years ago. Approved by the FDA as frontline or second-line treatment for advanced melanoma. Enhances survival, and there's durable responses. Again, that idea that the lucky patients, they have this durable response. It's observed in 15 to 20% of patients. Something we've seen for a number of different tumor types, responses can be delayed. So it doesn't necessarily mean to stop treating with immunotherapy if you don't see an immediate reduction in tumor volume. So you could have, in some instances, you'll actually see patients progress. They'll actually see the tumors get larger. But when you keep treating later on, these patients actually have a reduction in tumor volume. It's associated with a number of different immune-mediated side effects. It's a little bit more toxic, aggressive, whatever the term I want to use here, compared to anti-PD-1. Colitis, dermatitis has been associated with CTLA-4. Okay, so moving on to dendritic cell vaccination. So this is a little bit different. When we think of high-dose IL-2, anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1, those are therapies that can be taken off the shelf. You take a drug literally off the shelf, and you can inject into a patient, or, you know, however it's delivered, give them a pill. Dendritic cell vaccines, adoptive T-cell transfer, these are a cellular treatment. You know, you actually have to work from cells provided by the patient in order to deliver these treatments. So really what we're talking about mostly is ex vivo generated dendritic cells. So oftentimes what will be done here is you'll harvest blood from patients and from there enrich monocytes, use a cytokine cocktail to create a dendritic cell, and then that is fed an antigen which is delivered back to the patient. CIFT, this is an approved treatment for metastatic prostate cancer, and that's exactly how this works as well. So from blood, they culture monocytes into antigen-presenting cells that are fed this fusion, PAP, which is the antigen, to GM-CSF, to be used as a cellular vaccine for these patients. It induces antibody and T-cell responses, but, you know, here, you know, the initial approval was a four-month prolonged survival benefit compared to standard of care, but the benefits really haven't been what we would have hoped for from the initial study, few objective biological responses. So where we're all moving to, and I don't think it matters if you're necessarily in immunotherapy, if you're really interested in this type of therapy, but the questions for us all, I think, are the same, okay? And we're kind of stuck in a certain area. We've seen patients, you know, that are responding to therapy. So there's about 20% of patients responding to therapy with these types of treatment. You know, so the question is really, you know, how do we change this so we have more patients responding, or, you know, can we decrease this portion of the pie chart? Another outstanding question is, you know, can we identify responding patients prior to treatment? Is there a biomarker, an indicator of, you know, who's going to respond or who isn't going to respond? Even, I'll go back to high-dose IL-2, even if with the toxicity and the management that's associated with that treatment, if we knew who responded or who wasn't going to respond, you can make good decisions on patient management. So in terms of combination, here's an example of a clinical trial that was performed by Tom Schwab and Mark Ernsthoff. This trial was performed at Dartmouth, but now they're both here. Dr. Ernsthoff is shared medicine here, but this trial was performed at Dartmouth a few years ago. This is kind of the classical way we think of DC vaccines. You enrich monocytes from peripheral blood, you culture them ex vivo into dendritic cells. They used IL-4, GM-CSF, which is standard, and then a maturation cocktail. It's just another separate cytokine cocktail later on. There's no test on the cytokines used for the DC vaccine. And then pulsed here, Tom and Mark pulsed the dendritic cells with autologous tumor cell lysate. So you actually take the tumor, you treat with radiation to kill it, and then you feed that to the dendritic cells. So you're giving the dendritic cells all of those antigens. The common antigens, the mutated antigens, they get everything. And then these dendritic cells were injected directly into the patient's lymph node. So they're going directly to the site of activation, directly to where they actually have to activate the T cells. This treatment strategy was supplemented with interferon alpha and high-dose IL-2 therapy. And the goal here was, you know, biologically to boost the anti-tumor response and therapeutically to have an effect on outcome. And here's what happened. So the small trial, there's only 18 patients. There's 50% of patients, really, there wasn't much of a response. They had stable disease, they had progressive disease. But 50% of patients, the other 50%, and these are all metastatic kidney cancer patients, responded to treatment. And three complete responders, meaning, again, after treatment, there was no detectable disease. And here's evidence of one of the responses in a lymph node here after treatment. You can see it's gone away. We've updated the results from this trial. So 18 patients, now we're almost 10 years out. Five of them are still alive, which is pretty incredible. That's all the three complete responders are still alive. One of them still has no detectable disease. So it's, you know, there's not a lot of patients on it, but you know, for the patients, for some of them, they received a significant benefit. Okay, so what's coming down the pipeline now? Everyone's thinking about how we can combine strategies to overcome the limitations of what we currently have. So tyrosine kinase inhibition, targeting strategies, axitinib, combined with PD-1. Let's try these two together. You know, we have about a 20% response rate with each one. What happens when we put them together? This is a recent study that was published in Lancet Oncology. Roswell Park participated in the study. So Dr. Puzinov, Sabi George, both recruited for the study. And this is extremely exciting. So look at this waterfall plot. These are metastatic RCC patients. And you can just see, you know, this is the line that is considered a response, right? 30%. Okay, you can see how many of these patients, I can't remember, I think there's like 40 of them on it, benefited after therapy. Metastatic RCC, very difficult disease to treat. And the results really are, you can just see right away. something I think you might want to take away from this as well. You know, you didn't necessarily have to have an immediate response to treatment. You can see this patient in green. They were progressive disease, and now it looks like you can't find it. So it's not always about how things are looking immediately after treatment. But you know, this is a really exciting study, and I hope when we expand the numbers, we see consistent results with this, because for as aggressive as this disease can be, these are really exciting findings. An idea of overall survival, so almost 30 months out, looks to be above 75% overall survival. So again, very encouraging. And I just took this right out from the paper. At data cutoff, 38 patients, 73% achieved an objective response. So very exciting results in a study that Roswell Park participated in. 8% complete response rate. You know, so it's not everyone that I mentioned that dramatic effect. It's not just about the complete response. You know, a lot of these patients achieved a benefit but still have residual disease. You know, an obvious combination here. I talked about how PD-1 and CTLA-4, they're probably working in different microenvironments, but they're both boosting an anti-tumor immune response, combining these two together. So PD-1 inhibition with CTLA-4. This is an abstract that was published last year, so we're still waiting for the proper manuscript to be published. At least I couldn't find it yet. And they did this in comparison to standard of care with sunitinib. So they saw a 9.4 complete response rate when they combined the two regimens together, compared to 1.2% with sunitinib. But really, this is where there's a large difference, it seems to me at least, is in the poor risk patient group. So patients that don't normally have good prognosis. Here you're observing, 42% objective response rate in the combination strategy, and sunitinib about 27%. A statistically significant improvement there in terms of patient survival, or not survival, in terms of response rate. What about biomarkers? This is something that we're really interested in, predicting who respond, who won't respond. I didn't mention earlier, but renal cell carcinoma is also sort of an outlier. Many of these immunotherapy-responsive, sensitive tumor types, they have high levels of neoantigens, high levels of mutated antigens. And one of the outstanding questions in our field has always been, why does renal cell carcinoma respond if it's not expressing these unique, what are supposed to be immunogenic antigens? What's really happening here? And one indicator could be that infiltration. You have a large amount of T cells infiltrating, and you're overcoming that hurdle from the very beginning. Renal cell carcinoma was classified as, not only does it have the highest levels of infiltration, but the highest levels of cytolytic activity in the tumor microenvironment. But it still doesn't answer the question of why it's sensitive, if you don't have the targets themselves. So this paper doesn't go all the way there, but it gives us very good indication of who's responding to treatment and what's different about them. They did genomic profiling of, and it was just published in Science, and our working group recently reviewed this paper, not for the journal, for our own interest, and they found that PBRM1, a loss of function in this gene, really correlated with who benefited from therapy. So clinical benefit in green, these patients, they had, they just found that that gene was, not only was it mutated, but it was non-functional in the patients that had a clinical benefit. And they're trying to chase it down. They did a lot of different transcriptional analysis of what pathways are affected when you have mutation of this gene. And to me, that part of it wasn't as convincing as their clinical data showing that this had an effect on or could predict who responded to therapy. So just to round out today's talk, I mentioned earlier The questions, you know, how can we improve responses, combining treatments. And that's kind of, I think, where everyone's going. There's probably not one magic bullet we can take off the shelf to get to a patient that'll take care of everything. It's probably a cocktail we have to put together. PD-1, CTLA-4, does high-dose IL-2 play a role? Does cellular therapy play a role? A combination of treatments, I think, is where we're all going to achieve this greater response rate. Can responding patients be identified prior to therapy? I gave you some evidence of genomic markers. We have a study that hopefully will be coming out from our lab soon that I think can give an indicator of response to dendritic cell therapy. There's other groups, of course, looking at PD-1, PD-L1 expression, who responds, who doesn't respond to checkpoint strategies. It's going to be a question we're going to track down in all these different disease types. Okay. Any questions for me? No. Okay. Thanks.